Okay, here we are again. Now, Chris, let's have a look at the non-fiction categories. First of all, the illustrated non-fiction. What were the entries like there? I'd imagine you were talking earlier about production values. This is obviously where they're going to shine through. Did they shine through consistently, or was this one of the places where the ones that weren't up to par really stood out?
Look, yes, there was a consistency. There are some just absolute knockout books that there from a production point of view. But, you know, we're looking for something that's more than a coffee table book here. And even though, you know, that's the illustration is the leading part of the category. But there was the standouts were so strong that there was no doubt amongst the judges of the books that rose to the top. So
in that context, Playing with Fire is an interesting book because that's not self-published, but it's a fairly minor publication in many respects. I think it was published by the Potter Society themselves, perhaps in liaison with a smaller publisher.
Yeah.
You pick that one over, you know, there's books like The Fantastica, The World of Leo Benzerman last year, Fiona Partington, The Pressure of Sunlight Falling, you know, big, impressively produced books. So tell us a little bit about that one.
Sorry, we've got the 9:34 to West Auckland, passing by the window. Yes, that's the one that took us all by surprise, the Playing with Fire. It's because it's an odd one because it's written by a variety of authors and there's also a variety of the visual images, which is really hard to pull off and not make a book look too scrapbooky. It's the love of the potters for the work that they do that really comes through, and it's written in an anecdotal style, but it really gets the sense of the social times the period of these when pottery was so big in New Zealand. So yeah, there's a strong element of social history there as well. At the front of the book is a good essay by Justin Payton, but that's the only really piece of art writing in the book. There are other writers like Peter Longy describing the pottery world in which he moved. There's a lovely portfolio of photos at the end by Marty Friedlander. So yeah, together it's the old, you know, you think of pottery as was so strong and collective, and that's what's come through in this book. That's the unconventional book amongst the five.
The Murray Cloakes book is just a sumptuous book, isn't it?
Oh yeah, you can almost it's the most tactile book that came through. You know, you could really just feel those feathers they almost had a scent. The photos are so impressive of these Murray Cloakes, really gets their beauty and the detail, and you know, to take such a small element. It's not unlike the book that won, the Te Whaiwhai book that won last year. To just take one small element and concentrate with such a magnifying glass.
And that's one of the wonderful things is they take a small element and then they, as you say, magnify even a smaller element within the small element, and as a result of which some of those cloaks just look like artworks. They are artworks, but you know, they just look like some abstract artwork when you focus in so closely on them.
Yeah. Another book that was, you know, it's this mix of content and the beauty of the images and production and their choice, the choice of images and how they convey the story. And that's really sums up the New Zealand Film book, which is an illustrated history of New Zealand film. It's never been done as well as this before. There's different writers for each chapter, but there's a consistent voice throughout. But the images, thanks to the New Zealand Film Archive being the main backer of the book, with Te Papa Press, that gets the wide variety of New Zealand film history in one spot. And the great thing is thank God there's not too much cultural theory in the book, you know.
Always a danger with film writing.
Yeah, you know, you don't want those theorists who are just writing for each other when you're writing a general history of New Zealand film. You know, it reaches the New Zealand public, but it has an intelligence. There's no doubt about that.
And that's, I mean, that shines too in terms of art writing with Gregory O'Brien as well, with that the Graham Percy book. Tell us a bit about that one.
Oh, well, what really took us with the Gregory O'Brien book is just its original approach to the subject. He's it's an illustrated biography, really, of Graham Percy, this illustrator who started out with the School Journal in the 60s here in New Zealand, but then quickly moved over to London, where he had a long career. And his work has retained that kind of a childlike sense of wonder, and that's what Greg gets in the both the text and the illustrations he's chosen. He immersed himself in Percy's world. He lived in his house while writing the book, and gets that idea of this treasure chest of a house where all Percy's artworks and also the things that inspired him all helped support his work. And so it was the originality of the whole approach that really impressed us.
And finally on that list, New Zealand's native trees.
Yeah, well, this is the Tananahuta of tree books. Only comes along once in a generation, and you can really feel the love of everybody involved in this book. The editors, the photographers, and of course the John Dawson, who is the main force behind it, Rob Lucas is the photography, and this really shows how you've got to get, if you've got a topic of a non-fiction topic, going into it with a half-hearted approach and cutting corners is a mistake, because it gets in the way of other books. You know, you're only going to do this once in a generation, and if again at all, I always find it such a disappointment when books cross your desk and you think this is a great idea for a book, it's a necessary book, and yet it's only half done. There's nothing that's been left out with this book.
Who's the publisher there with that one?
That's Craig Potten Publishing.
Ah, Craig Potten, yes. And everybody, so, I mean, both Craig Potten and Te Papa, they really do put the money into those picture books, don't they?
Yeah, they really have that sense that this book is going to be around for a long time and we have to get it right. Both Te Papa and Craig Potten. There's not that sense of speed to get things to market.
Now, moving on to the general non-fiction, I can't help but note, four of the five there are history books. Was that the dominant presence in the overall submissions?
Let's think.
Just while
you... God, it's such a big category, you know.
Mm. I mean, you talked about a lot of entries. What were the entries like there for?
So, yeah, there's, God, 67 entries to this. But, you know, they range from family histories, which are really only of interest to the family, to memoirs that are, again, either only of interest to the family or, you know, the popular memoir like Paul Henry, through to works of great scholarship, such as one of the ones on the shortlist, Anne Salmon's work on Bligh. But, yeah, 67 books, so there is a... there's an inconsistency to the quality, you know. A third of those rise to the top, you know.
I'm still sitting here boggling from the idea that somebody saw fit to submit the Paul Henry book. But anyway, I'll slowly recover from that thought. Just going through the list.
Well,
now,
the book's called What Was I Thinking, isn't it? Yeah,
that's right. big hitters, obviously, on your shortlist. Anne Salmond, Joan Druitt, Fiona Farrell, Peter Wells, the lesser-known Peter Graham there, too. It was a big year for the big, big non-fiction writers.
Yes, and so there you've got both Anne Salmond and Joan Druitt both considering Pacific explorers, one who's been written about endlessly for the last 200 years, that's William Bligh, and the other, Tupaia, who hasn't been given his moment in the sun by the very Cook-centric approach to history in the past, but also the explorer of Colenso by Peter Wells, which is, again, a very original take on it. It's not a straight scholarly work like, say, Anne Salmond's. This is a book, it's like a travel book, like a Jonathan Raven book, in which the author is present throughout. And of the other books, well, Peter Graham's book on the Parker Hume murder is an excellent popular history. You know, it's both compelling, of course, this is a subject that's been written about so much over the last 50 years in Peter Jackson's film. Also, there's a lot in the popular domain, a lot of knowledge already there, but he gets into the, because his legal background comes through in the way he covers the trial and the legal issues that came through there, but it's a terrific read.
And Fiona Farrell,
and Fiona Farrell's
the very
book.
Contemporary book there, really, in many respects. I mean, obviously, exactly. Given the year.
So here's a work of art about an incident that, you know, the Christchurch earthquake that, you know, only took place just over a year ago. And the broken book, well named because it interrupted the book she was going to write, which would have been a book about walking a lot of it overseas. And her world was turned upside down like so many others with the Christchurch earthquake, and interspersed through the book poems reflecting on the earthquake. But there's so many different tangents to the book. She talks about Robert Louis Stevenson at one point and walks through Spain, and but she manages to pull it all together so that the book reflects on the Christchurch earthquake that's disrupted everything. The poems are very strong in that, and add so much more to just from what would have possibly been quite a conventional travel book.
And finally, the best first book there, which would be one I could have seen happily in either of the non-fiction categories in some respects, a very well illustrated offering.
Yeah, and this is the New Zealand by Design by Michael Smythe, and it's a book about New Zealand's industrial design, and so all the little widgets that we've been involved with, but it's a terrific read. It's very funny. It's very reliable in its historical account, but he captures the inventiveness of the designers and also the problems that they had to solve, which didn't just involve issues of, you know, how to invent an electric fence. There's political issues there as well, and the lost opportunities we've had through lack of foresight from politicians, or just the economic times being wrong. One thing they haven't conquered yet, the industrial designers, is noise pollution.
Chris, for those of you who are wondering, is in a house in Auckland, which is rather near to a railway line, so we've hopefully removed the worst of that, but we might have left in a few bits and bobs, but it's all part of the texture of these things. Moving on to the Māori Language Award, kind of almost a meta award in this case, because it's actually about the whole place of the Māori language, Chris Winatana. That book, many contenders, because that's always a question in that category.
There weren't many contenders for this one, but you can also have no award, you know, if there aren't enough entries. And but it was decided that this was strong enough to have won nevertheless, because it he gets the human story behind keeping the language alive, and that he's really done his he's worn out a lot of shoe leather getting around the leading characters in the renaissance of Maori language.
Getting the awards down to these shortlists, Blood on the Carpet, everybody happy? How did that go?
I think we were all happy with the shortlist once we discussed things.
Said that in a very sinister Tony Soprano's like way.
No, what's good about it is that you've got these, you know, various people are strong in their own fields, and you can learn so much from, like, for me, there were a couple of people really strong on the panel on poetry. There's Paula Green and David Eggleton, and what you learn from, you know, you come to it as a general reader, what you learn from them was so valuable. But in the discussions, other people bring up things about books that you hadn't thought of, and you and do it so convincingly that you do change your mind through the long discussions. You know, that's what the panel's there for, to thrash out the issue and say, well, okay, I see your point there. I've missed that.
You were on the other side of this process rather successfully last year. Did being on the other side of the process kind of inform the way that you approached it, being a judge?
Yeah, it did, really, because you're looking at a book as a whole. You know, with nonfiction, it goes right through to the quality index and the and how the referencing is done, as well as just the readability of the text. So that really did help. Those elements were there last year, and how does you can kind of see with the ones lower down the list where they might have missed out.
I remember hearing an interview a couple of years ago with one of the Nobel Prize judges, and he said that when he went on holiday, he had to always take a sort of dummy book. He would take Jane Austen or something, and then he would have the actual book that they were considering for the Nobel Prize hidden behind it. In a country as small as New Zealand, how do you manage to hide what you're reading when you get down to this stage? Presumably you reread for the, when you choose from the three finalists, you will probably reread them all to do that. How are you kind of keeping it all secret? Are you having to hide away?
By not reading on in the middle of Unity Books, staying behind closed doors. And I know all the judges found this, that it's kind of it takes over your life for about 6 months, getting through all the books and then rereading the finalists. You've got to stay pretty coy through that time. You've got to really bring out your poker playing abilities.
And have you now chosen the winners, or is that still to come?
The winners are chosen, yeah.
They are all chosen, so your reading life is back with you?
But I want to dive back into some of these as well. You know, having heard, seeing what others have found in them, where I just found a good read,
That's probably the best recommendation. If after a year of this, you're happy to go back in again.
Yeah, maybe not immediately, but there's books there that really make a great contribution to one's library, you know, and will be very useful either just for entertainment or as definitive text.
Well, if anybody listens to this, has a look in the Listener magazine, there's an opportunity to win all the finalist books, so you'll be able to experience them as, not quite as Chris has, but you'll get a sense of perhaps what he's talking about there. And for the rest of us, August the 1st, is that right, Chris, the announcement?
August the 1st.
Yep. August the 1st. So we'll find out who the winners are on August the 1st, and well, there'll be more coverage, obviously, here on the listener website. Thank you very much indeed, Chris.
Thanks, Guy.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again with one of these sometime in the future. Who knows when? They're very erratic. Thanks very much. Bye.